Events last month in Charlottesville highlighted what seems like a growing presence of neo-Nazi, white supremacist, and white nationalist groups in the United States. Until recently, most of us used the term Nazi in reference to World War II, but now that history seems to be taking on a new life. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR Central Standard, we're going to hear how Nazism in Germany during World War II and all the symbolism that went along with it is being taught and understood today. I recently recorded an interview with Matt Beat. He's a history teacher at Tonganoxie High School, and he's a musician who writes songs about American presidents, which has made him a minor YouTube sensation.
Hello.
Can I call you Mr. Beat?
You can call me that. That's fine.
Okay. What about that? I mean, are your students asking questions about Nazis and the history of World War II that seem different than the kinds of questions you fielded about this time period in the past?
Yeah, I've had former students more than anything approach me because I had them last year and we learned about how we defeated the Nazis in World War II. And I guess their biggest reaction that I've noticed is just shock. It's like, I thought we were done with this. And I just basically always tell them, you know, these are fringe groups and they do this to get attention. These protests, these rallies, they're extremely small, is what I usually say. And because they get worried about the future. It does seem like the past is coming back sometimes.
For you, I mean, grown-ups don't know what's going to happen. Is it hard to sometimes provide the reassurance, or do you do that pretty confidently?
I would say it can be difficult. I mean, especially when it seems like the last couple of years have been a little bit more chaotic. I think I always go back to the faith in our institutions, our Constitution, just each other as Americans, and I'm a naturally positive person, so I think that helps a lot. But the students do need to hear about, you know, what has been going well, because it seems like when they turn on the media, they're getting all this negative information. And so I think I do feel like that guy is trying to always spin it in the positive way, like, you know, well, here's what good can come from what's happening right now.
What good do you think can come from what's happening right now? We're going to get into the history in just a second, but it's such a crazy position to imagine being in, to provide reassurance about the future based on history. But yeah, none of us know anything really.
Right. I can only basically give examples from history about how, you know, like during World War II, it did seem like the end of the world many times. Or during the Cold War, there were periods like in the early 60s where many Americans who lived through it felt like, this is it. You know, these are the end times. And there's always times like that where people are extremely worried. And I say, well, here's how it ended up becoming better. Like how mutually assured destruction during the Cold War ultimately made it so that, crazy enough, we were safer. And so I guess telling them, giving them the full context of everything really helps just in general.
So looking back at the rise of Nazism in Europe and how Americans came to understand that to begin with and then get involved in that conflict overseas, are there things that people don't necessarily understand about that time period and about our historical relationship with the Nazis?
I would say so. Like in Germany, Nazis were elected. That's something that a lot of people forget. Another thing is that in the United States, there was Nazi support early on, like in the 1920s. Many German Americans in particular had, you know, they basically started their own Nazi party. They didn't call it that back then, but they were supporters of the Nazis. And they were small. They're just a few thousand. But their numbers did steadily grow in the 1930s, a time when fascism seemed to be on the rise everywhere in the world. So, and even look at Franklin Roosevelt, he wasn't a fascist, but look at the fact that because of the crazy time we were living, the Great Depression, the economic turmoil, that basically made it so people had more faith in one leader, and they were willing to reelect him multiple times. And
because he had pulled them out of that,
right? Give him more and more power. Roosevelt always had the best intentions and always had the Constitution to limit his power, not like these other countries in Europe. But I think even when the Nazis were existed in the 1930s, there were members of Congress who investigated them. It was always far fringe. They've always been around. They've always been on the radar for, you know, later on the FBI, the CIA, you know. But, you know, it is weird how they know how to get attention, don't they? To this day, same with the Ku Klux Klan. They always knew how to get media attention to try to promote their cause.
How did people in America first start learning about what was going on in Germany?
Well, they knew that Hitler and the Nazi Party had helped the German economy. Germany before in the 1920s with the Weimar Republic, it was so bad there. We can't even imagine how bad it was there, and so people were desperate to turn to any leader who, you know, would give any kind of sign of progress to turn things around so that they could feed their families. And so when Hitler came along, and you know, even if he abused his power, the economy was getting better. Things were slowly getting better. And so around the world, we saw that, okay, well, this Hitler guy, he seems radical, yes, but it seems that Germany's doing better. You look at 1938, he was, I believe, the person of the year, according to Time magazine, if I'm remembering correctly.
Which is not necessarily praised.
Not praised, but just he was having a huge impact.
By 1938, I mean, by then, his anti-Semitism was—it was being fully acted upon at that point.
Well, it was, but we didn't know about the Holocaust. I mean, we didn't know about the concentration camps, the extermination camps. So
that was still unknown here in America.
Oh yeah, at that time. So I think that was the tipping point, was the Holocaust. When the vast majority of human beings around the world just turned the swastika and everything related to Nazism into pure evil. And so, but I think since then, and sorry if I keep going here, but since then I've noticed that the swastika, kind of similar to the Confederate flag, has kind of evolved into like something as just a way to antagonize, like incite, you know, hatred, because it seems like you can really get people's attention quickly once you flash that symbol out, you know?
But that's understandable. I mean,
yeah.
You know, I mean, I have to say, like, as a Jewish person, that gets my attention. And I mean, yeah,
Well, I think about the school right after Election Day, after President Trump was elected, there was a school that had found a swastika on the sign, the sign at the front of the school. That was painted on there. And was this kid a Nazi? Probably not. But he knew how to, you know, get the attention. And so I feel like you can't ban a symbol necessarily, because there's always going to be those people that want to use that to provoke, you know, to get attention.
Well, let's back up and pick up where we were with the history. I mean, the process of people learning that the people were being killed systematically in Germany and in Europe. I mean, how did people begin to learn that information? And can you help take me there a little bit better?
The Allies, after they finally defeated Germany, the Russians coming in on both sides, they stumbled across these concentration camps. And, you know, there's...
So people didn't know that before going there?
In Germany, many historians say that, yeah, they knew that they were there. They didn't know all the details, but many probably knew that there were some horrible things that were going on there. Outside of Germany, it's not as clear. We really didn't know. Like, they were really good at covering up. Look at the fact that the Nazis burned everything as they left, as the Allies were coming in. And so I think they were good at hiding to the entire world what they were truly doing.
And so people you're saying came back and started sharing information of what they were discovering at concentration camps, like during the Allied intervention?
Yes. So, I mean, there's you can see the photos, you can see the footage. It was just such a revelation to the entire world that even if they had suspicions, they didn't know, like seeing that evidence. And that is why today, whenever I hear, talk of Holocaust denial, like I get a little upset about that because, the evidence is overwhelming. It didn't come until the end of the war that we saw all that.
The people who are in high school right now, I wonder if they are old enough to, if they've had an opportunity to meet people who either served in World War II for the United States or people who survived the Holocaust.
It's increasingly rare to find any survivor. I mean, World War II veterans are, I'm not sure the exact number, but it's a very small number now. And you look at Holocaust survivors, same thing. I mean, I used to actually work at a hospital, and one of the patients that I interacted with regularly was a Holocaust survivor, and it was just so valuable for me to have conversations with him. And he actually was open about his experiences, and he was just a little kid then. But that is so valuable to students when they can actually hear from people who live through it. I always try to bring into my classroom whenever I have an opportunity, bring in somebody who lived through something to share firsthand what they experienced.
How do you teach about World War II to your students?
Well, in American history, it's mostly it's that war that where it does quite seem there is a clear good guy and a clear bad guy. There's a lot of gray area with most wars. But if you look at the full context of it, it started out, I teach to the students that it became a war of, trying to prevent this empire from spreading and conquering. But then it ended by becoming a war of ideals where, we were on the side of justice, so it's definitely, I teach it differently than any other war for that reason. It's more black and white than with gray area for sure.
How do you explain to students? I mean, I have to assume that when you teach about World War II, this comes up periodically, what it was that made it possible for someone like Hitler to take power and to persuade huge numbers of people to do things that most of us understand as just totally morally bankrupt.
There is one documentary I do show my kids, and I forgot to mention, it's called Five Steps to Tyranny. It's from the early 2000s from the BBC, and it explains exactly how this is possible. It's just based on human psychology, and every human being is susceptible to this being this way if under the right conditions, under the wrong conditions is a better way to put it. So the five steps of tyranny, it starts with just having in and out groups. You have one group that thinks they are superior to the others. And then it just builds to the fifth and final step, which is genocide, basically justifying that. And so I think to think that it can't happen anywhere is naive. It can happen anywhere, even in the United States of America.
And that brings me back, I guess, to some of the reassurance from before. I mean, let's just take a look at the period post-World War. I mean, this... Like you said, people felt that Nazism had been defeated forever. Or did they? Did people believe that right after the war?
I like to think that they did. I think the circumstances were so unique and most people, I'm saying, obviously there's always cynicism. But, whenever I teach about genocide in general, I always talk about more recent events. I look at like what happened in Rwanda. That was in my lifetime, and I remember as a kid seeing that, and I was like, wait, kind of like our kids today seeing Nazis out in the streets. Like, I thought this was over. I thought we were done with this, And so the students, like when I tell them that North Korea currently has concentration camps, a lot of times that blows their minds. They have no idea that that's actually something that's happening as I'm talking to you right now. And so, but that has the most impact. And that's the thing is, I know you asked me like what makes me more optimistic here on how we can overcome this maybe, but I think the first step is just them knowing and realizing, you know, like, hey, there's still this bad stuff happening, and we defeated it before, we can defeat it again.
For people who are between the ages of like 14 and 18, which is pretty much what you are dealing with as a high school teacher, the sense of how long ago was a long time ago is very different than it is for adults. I mean, I remember being in high school telling my own dad, like, he said something about World War II to me. It had happened in his own lifetime, and he said something about it. And I said, well, Dad, that was a long time ago. And I remember that really bothered him. But for a person whose whole life has been 15 years, anything that happened in a previous generation is a long time ago. And this time period seems to be so, there seems to be so much history coming back up. Does history feel like a long time ago to your students, or has that changed?
Well, history is, it never went away. It's always there. It's like, the people really don't change. The technology changes, the specific people that are in power, and all the details change. But as far as who we are as human beings never changes. And anybody who says that that isn't related to me, you're a human being, and human beings act in predictable ways, which I think students are always attracted to psychology. At our school, we have a psychology class, and that always has a lot of people interested. But I think you're right. It is harder to get them more passionate about American history or world history. For that reason, they don't connect it. And so how I typically teach it is I try to make it relevant. But how I do that is current events, but also just like try to get them in, like have them imagine living in that time. Like if they can really truly feel like they're in the shoes of the average American living in 1945, then they'll have a better chance to understand, like, and understand its relevance and how it's connected to them.
It sounds like, unfortunately, that part of your job might have gotten easier.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, I'm positive because I can use that to our advantage to learn from these mistakes, I'm hoping. So,
well, Matt Beat, Mr. Beat, with us from Tonganoxie High School, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Mr. Beat's lesson about American perceptions of Nazis during World War II was a little surprising and left us in some ways with more questions than answers. That's what good teachers do, right? So after the break, we're consulting with a World War II historian. If you have a question about America's response to the Nazi movement in Germany, call 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. You're listening to KCUR's Central Standard. And before the break, we were chatting with a high school teacher from Tonganoxie about what it's like to answer students' questions about World War II, given that Nazi rallies and swastikas are showing up close to home in today's headlines. Some of what he said really surprised us. It surprised me anyway, so we're going to dig a little deeper. Shelley Klein is here. She's a public historian with the Midwest Center for Holocaust Education. Hi, Shelley.
Hello.
So the part of Mr. Beat's history lesson that surprised me, it sounded like, from his account, Americans didn't really know the extent of the violence being committed by Nazis until they were on the ground fighting in World War II. I always thought outrage over the inhumanity of the Nazis was why we were there. Help me out.
Well, I think we have to first distinguish between knowledge and comprehension. And there was a fair amount of some sort of knowledge about what's happening in Europe during this time. And even if we back up from the actual period of killing and genocide and look at what we knew in the 30s, we were certainly aware of legislative moves against the Jews in Germany, going back to the Nuremberg Laws in 1935.
Remind us what those were.
Those were laws, constitutional changes to the German Constitution, which stripped basically German Jews of their citizenship and other basic civil rights, really designating to be being Jewish as a racial class rather than a religious class. So it's a huge removal of civil rights at this time and something that made headlines here in America. So that's something that we were aware of. Later in the 30s, Kristallnacht, the pogrom that happened in 1938, violent action against the Jews within Germany and German-controlled territories, that's something that America was aware of.
Kristallnacht,
as well.
And that's the, you know, the night of shattered glass.
Yes, the night of broken glass. So those are things that certainly made headlines in America. We were aware of this. We were also aware of the refugee crisis that was happening. And so people are looking to get out of Europe. And that's something that was of discussion in America. What do we do with these people? Do we let them in? Do we not? Unfortunately, the decision was not made to relax immigration quotas. And so a lot of people who wanted to get out could not. So that's a part of the discussion that was certainly alive and well in the U.S. Once we start talking about the actual killing, the first times that we're really going to hear about that is when Germany invades the Soviet Union in 41. And there are some reports of these mass killing actions that happened in that Soviet territory. So you see the Wehrmacht, the German army, going into Soviet territory. Behind them follow these mobile killing groups. And they go through, find anyone who is Jewish in towns and villages, and they kill them. Reports of that did make their way back to the U.S. But again, these are things that they're wartime reports. They're also coming through some
reports in the newspapers?
There were some reports in the newspapers, some even in the Times, but...
Are we talking like page one or page seven?
Oh, we're talking page seven. We're talking really, really buried. And this is also a time when there's a lot of wartime news. So I think that's always really important to keep in mind that the knowledge we do get is coming in the context of war. And it's also, if it's coming from Soviet sources, there are some doubts about that. So keep that in mind. We do get some knowledge then later in, you know, 42, once the killing centers are up and running. But again, these are coming through Soviet sources. Are they real? Are they not? So even when we get the information, it's hard to necessarily fully believe it and, again, comprehend it. So that difference between knowledge and comprehension is really key here.
Tell me more about the difference between knowledge and comprehension from your perspective as someone who specializes in this period of history that is so hard to comprehend. I've been learning about it pretty much my whole life. I find it very hard to comprehend still.
I think that's a very normal response. It is hard to comprehend. One of the things that, you know, we're always learning more about this time period, and something that we should keep in mind, too, is there were over recent research shows us that there were over 45,000 camps and ghettos across occupied Europe. I mean, that's really a staggering number. When you think about 45,000 of these places, what does that mean in terms of geography? So what did people know? What did we know? Again, you can hear numbers, you can hear reports, but it takes a long time to really, really comprehend what it is that we're hearing and knowing in that way. So I think that, especially in terms of Allied knowledge, it comes when you see the places, when we get the photographs, when you hear the stories, that's when you can start to comprehend. That's when it means something more than just a numbers or a report of mass killing.
It's easy, I think, to forget that Nazis started as a political movement and that it took a while, at least for people to recognize them as a humanitarian crisis. Can you help me understand how that progression unfolded?
Well, I think one of the things the Nazis were very effective at doing is using the legal system and the pre-existing systems within Germany. So they came to power legally, and by using those pre-existing institutions, it gave them a legitimacy. So they pass a lot of laws throughout the 30s that strip people of their rights.
What rights?
Well, like I said, the Nuremberg Laws, it removes citizenship, removes the ability for Jews and non-Jews to marry. Before that, there were laws limiting Jews' participation in civil society. They couldn't be members of certain social clubs. They couldn't take certain professional examinations. Their entrance to the universities were limited. So little ways to sort of move people outside of mainstream society. But the important thing is they passed the laws. They made them legal. And so here in the West, if something's legal, well, it gives it a legitimacy. So that goes a long way towards sort of warming up the rest of society to these actions.
You mentioned that people in the United States were also getting their information in the context of wartime news. I think the ability of people to have their outrage dimmed by the context of lots of other bad news is something that probably just on an international level we could relate to today. But we today hear this history tied up, you know, with a beginning, middle, and end. We know where it's going. We know how horrific that is. You know what I mean?
Yes, absolutely. We know where it's going, and sometimes it's hard to realize when we are actually in the middle of history. Sometimes we're very well aware of it, and sadly other times we aren't, and we don't know when is that moment that we realize we are, and it's time to do something.
When you talked earlier about the conversations about a refugee crisis from Europe, and particularly Germany, but not exclusively Germany, leading up to and during World War II, you said that conversation was alive and well. What did that conversation sound like?
I think you see, there's a lot of pressure from groups within America, Jewish groups within America, calling for the refugee crisis to be answered, the immigration quotas to be opened up so that we could allow people fleeing Europe a place to go. When I say alive and well, I mean it's something, this is something that would have been featured. The Evian Conference is something that Roosevelt, he calls this conference in 1938 to discuss with the Western world, what should we do about the refugee crisis? And pretty much they decide, well, we don't have a solution. So there was no answer that came out of it. But that's something that, again, was featured in newspapers. So people were aware, much like we're aware of discussions of letting in refugees and immigrants in today's world. That's something we're aware of. That's something that people in the 30s would have been aware of as well.
Mr. Beat, the history teacher we talked to earlier, said that at a certain point in America and really around the world, Nazism and its symbols became synonymous with pure evil. Was there a turning point, like a moment where that became true?
I don't know if I could point to an exact moment. I do think that when we start liberating the camps in the West and our armies come across places like Dachau and Bergen-Belsen, and we see the true horrors of the Holocaust in terms of what it looked like in the West, I think that because that was so... those images were so powerful, I think that's when we start to use that terminology. I'm not sure that using the word evil is necessarily useful or productive in terms of talking about causality and agency among the people perpetrating it. But certainly I think that post-war moment where we saw some of those really graphic images that seemed unbelievable, even in a world that was used to war at that point, that's probably the closest turning point I could come to.
Do you think that we are revisiting those symbols and those ideas today? Or do you think that for most people, the swastika, the idea of Nazism, that those things are still synonymous with evil?
I think they still carry that real weight of evil. But I think that it's always important to keep in mind how we got to that point. And so that's why I think, you know, you mentioned earlier that the Nazis began as a political party, one that was seen as legitimate, both in Germany and other parts of the world, to remember that legitimacy and how something can go from seemingly legitimate to what we now think of as pure evil. So remembering those groundings and to be watchful for that.
Your job title is really interesting to me. I find it fascinating that the Midwest Center for Holocaust Education has a public historian. That is not a title that you hear a lot. And I'm wondering if there's something about this chapter in history that creates particular needs regarding information and education.
I think that this is a period of history that people are naturally fascinated by. And unfortunately, with more interest also comes a lot of misinformation. And so it's important as an institution to be able to provide the right information, good historical accuracy, and not just the most salacious parts, because this is a period of history, especially the Holocaust, is something that people can only want to see, you know, sort of like a random horrors approach rather than understanding how this systematically happened.
Is there a lesson from World War II that you think we should be paying particular attention to right now?
I think perhaps the biggest lesson is just to remember that this was carried out by ordinary individuals. The safe, comfortable answer we want when it comes to Nazis is that they were monsters and sadists. It's safe and comfortable because it makes them not like us. And I think the most important thing to remember is that human nature is deeply flawed, and we're all susceptible to various pressures and movements and ideas. And only when we start to understand perpetrators as people, as ordinary individuals, can we start to understand causality.
Shelley Klein, thank you so much. Up next, Kevin Wilmot's been wearing his bulletproof vest on campus at KU as a way of protesting conceal carry for a few weeks now. How's that been going? Find out after the break. Hi, Kevin.
Hi.
That is filmmaker and KU professor Kevin Wilmot, best known for his movie CSA, or Confederate States of America, a satire asking what America would look like if the South had won the Civil War. But now he's got a new claim to fame, the bulletproof vest he's been wearing to classes since conceal carry went into effect on campus at KU. Call 816-235-2888 if you want to talk to him about it. So, Kevin, when and how did you decide to make this back-to-school wardrobe choice?
Yes. Well, you know, when the policy when it was carried out, and we, you know, most faculty have been talking about this for a long time now, a couple of years almost. And when the policy came into effect, we had several meetings on campus, and deans were kind of telling us how the policy would be enacted. And
was it like training in some ways?
Almost like training, yes. And how, you know, explaining kind of how the policy worked, you know, that they could not, that a student, if they have a gun, that we can't ask them if they have a gun, and they can't tell us if they have a gun. We aren't allowed to see the gun.
And remind us, what is the reason behind that? I mean, that's the conceal part of conceal carry.
Yeah, I guess that's the conceal part of it. You know, so it's kind of a don't ask, don't tell kind of policy. You know, it's like, you know, don't ask the student if he has a gun. He can't tell you if he has a gun. We can't see the gun. If we see the gun, we can then report it to, you know, to the authorities.
So the idea is kind of that could be construed as a threat?
Maybe, yes. It's one of these things where it's really kind of hard to know what exactly the ideas are behind some of this. But the gun has to be unloaded, but they can have ammunition in their book bag. So when that was being taught, you know, was being instructed to us at a big faculty staff meeting, there was a Muslim professor that I happened to be sitting next to, and she was just frightened to death. She was just frightened to death.
Can you tell me more about how you understood that? I mean, what was she saying to you?
She was just saying, she just turned to me. She said, "I'm just scared to death. I'm just scared to death." And she said, "This is going to just stifle free speech in my class. I can't say the things I'm used to saying in class now. We can't have those conversations. Somebody might take something wrong. Somebody could get angry. These are young people. These are young people. You know, they're not, you know, you have to be 21 or older to have a weapon in class." And so it just really struck me how insane the whole notion of this policy was.
So, in that moment when that colleague of yours was expressing how she felt?
Yes, very much so. And it really touched me because, I think so many times you look at these kind of issues and they are, you kind of think about them in kind of in an intellectual kind of sense, you know, that however you feel about it politically, you kind of voice your opinion about it. But in that moment, it turned very real to me. It turned into the very thing that we do in campus and college life is our job is to really open people up to have them make the thing we are teaching real for them. And dialogue is kind of the key element of that. I mean, dialogue is and free speech and dialogue is where most people learn. That's where they really kind of comprehend the things that they're learning, and And this is going to change all of that.
So the idea of the bulletproof vest, did it just come to you or?
Yeah, well, you know, since we've been thinking about this a long time, I've been thinking, well, you know, what would be the response to this? I grew up in Kansas. And so Kansas, I'm not a professor that came from out of state and just happened to take a job here. I grew up in Kansas. And so Kansas, I love Kansas. And I love KU. And so for me, you know, the policy was kind of another kind of moment that where you saw Kansas really declining. And where it was really how it's been declining in the last few years in various ways. And you know, I grew up in Kansas being a moderate state. And so the vest for me was just a response. In that very meeting that I've been talking about, I asked the dean if a bulletproof vest was acceptable to wear. And he said, wear whatever you feel you need to wear to be feel safe. And so I chose to wear the vest as a protest to the policy.
Is the vest really like self-protection or do you see it really strictly as this form of protest, this form of expression about where you stand on this policy and how you're going to engage with it?
Well, for me, it's really just a form of protest. You know, I'm not afraid of my students. You know, people think about, you know, people have suggested to me, well, you could also carry a gun. I could carry a gun as well in class. And I could, as long as it's hidden from the students, I could carry a gun. But I don't want to shoot a student. I don't want to shoot a student. And I don't want to shoot a student to shoot me. And I don't want a student to shoot my other students that I have in class. And so for me, you know, the vest ends up kind of making this hidden thing, this hidden policy. It makes the hidden policy real, and it makes the invisible visible. So when I'm teaching in class, the students know this policy is real, and that someone in class may have a gun. And if they thought we were in an emergency situation, they could maybe pull it out and start shooting at people. And so I just think the vest for me was just a way to kind of, you know, let my feelings be known about the policy and to maybe find a way for faculty and others to respond to this policy.
Are you still wearing it?
I wear it every time I teach class.
You know, I'm curious about how your students are responding to that. There's been a lot of public interest in it, but then when you're in that classroom and there's how many students in your classes?
My big class is probably, I've got one class that's about 50 students and another that's about 30, 40 students. And, I try to make it as normal as I can. I don't want to punish my students because of this insane policy. I mean, I just wear the vest and then I do the thing I've been doing for 20 years.
But are your students asking you questions about it?
You know, I had a student, that entered my class late and, you know, he'd missed a couple classes and he's from Mexico City. And so he came up to me at the end of class the other day. And so he had missed my whole, you know, syllabus where I read the syllabus where I have the gun policy in the syllabus. We all do now. And so I had to read.
Every class, the syllabus includes the gun policy?
Many of them do. And so, So I kind of had to let him know. He said, why are you wearing the vest? And I had to let him know that, well, students now can carry guns in class. And he was just shocked. And I said, so I'm wearing this vest as a protest to that policy. And he said, well, why isn't the school doing something about this? And I said, well, the legislature has forced this policy on the university, and there's a gag order where they can't even really speak out about the policy. And he was just amazed. He was just dumbfounded. And it was so funny because you would think that Mexico would be as a far more dangerous place than the United States. And so he comes here thinking that he's safe, but here we are, here he is sitting in a classroom where students could have guns.
Presumably are both students and people on staff who support this law, and I wonder if any of them have approached you and, I mean, yeah, found fault with what you are doing.
Sure, sure. You know, I have not heard from any staff people. Some staff people that are also wearing bulletproof vests now. And so they've sent me photographs of their vest and saying, I'm wearing a vest too. This is not a professor. This is another staff person. So I think, and there people write me and ask me how much did my vest cost? And you know, because they're actually afraid. I mean, the staff people especially, I think, can be afraid.
Non-academic staff
that are the, you know, the secretaries and the clerks and various things. I think they are afraid. So there's just kind of this thing on campus where people, you know, want to talk about it. They're privately talking about it. I think some people are really afraid. You know, the vest for me is a way to kind of, you know, very much like I do in my films, it becomes a means to really kind of address the issue.
Have you had any heated debates in your classes so far this semester?
You know, I don't really have typically heated debates. You know, we have debates, but clearly, you know, you're talking in my classes, especially we talk a lot about race. Sometimes we talk about religion. We talk about, sexual orientation at times. Those opportunities are there to happen, and students sometimes can have differences of opinion in class, typically not with me, but more students having different opinion with each other. And I could see that happening easily in many different classes.
You mentioned being from Kansas before, and I feel like maybe, do you feel like that shapes in some way the style of your protest, that it's a very pragmatic protest?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, for me, you know, it's not about, you know, attacking conceal and carry. It's really for gun control. It was really to me a common sense response to the what I find, you know, kind of what's nutty about this policy. And I don't think most people would ever even believe that you would introduce guns to students in a classroom. You'd say, yeah, I want you to bring your gun to class. You know, you have the right to bring your gun to class. That's just, if I wrote that in a script, I don't think you would believe it.
One of those reality stranger than fiction kind of things you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the last few years, not just in Kansas, but in Missouri as well, you know, I had a script I wrote about Joe McCarthy becoming president. And it was very much like my CSA film. And it opened with a guy in a campaign commercial shooting a machine gun in the commercial. And then actually, the governor of Missouri actually did that in a commercial. And so this thing I wrote as satire now has become real. And so, you know, that's the thing about, I think, the last few years in Kansas, especially, I kind of call it now the new Mississippi, where, you know, the Kansas I grew up in, I don't even recognize it anymore. You know, it has that moderate, that kind of Republicans and Democrats being able to work with each other, that moderate kind of common sense kind of thing that you just took for granted being from Kansas, that's kind of disappeared. And this policy with conceal and carry in the classroom, I think is maybe the best example of it.
You know, I know you are here to talk about conceal carry and to talk about that particularly on the KU campus, but with so much attention right now on the fate of Confederate monuments and the ever-present history of race in this country, I feel like I have to ask you, like, I'm really curious how you're feeling about the state of public discourse around that right now.
Well, excuse me. Yeah, it's really great to see what's happening right now. I mean, that was one of the main reasons why I made CSA, was because
See what's happening with the discussion about
the
monuments.
With the discussion about the monuments, yes. That those monuments were created, almost all of them were created as a testimony to segregation and Jim Crow. And they were a message that were being sent to especially black people at that time that the South did not lose the Civil War. The South won the Civil War, and they won in a sense that they held on to their way of life, and that way of life is now segregation. And that the whole thing about the monuments honoring people, those monuments don't exist where a battle took place or where someone died. Those monuments were created about Confederate figures to kind of honor them. And those Confederate figures murdered an American president. They enslaved a whole race of people. They fought the bloodiest war in American history to hold on to slavery specifically. And so there's nothing about the Confederacy that is American, that is honorable, or is part of our current way of life. And so, but we were all taught that it was. And I remember as a little kid, my father was born in 1898. He was 60 years old when I was born from Mississippi. And I remember I was drawing a Confederate flag, and I had seen it in a movie somewhere. And I was drawing this flag, and he said, "What are you drawing, son?" I said, "I seen this flag in this movie." He said, "Well, that's the flag of slavery, son." And that's what the Confederacy is. It has only really one meaning, and that meaning is white supremacy and slavery. And that's why the Nazis and the Klan adapted that flag to be the symbol of their organizations. And so, when we try to make these excuses and explanations about all of this, you only really need to look at how it's being carried out. And it's being carried out by the Nazis and the Klan, and they know what that flag means.
What do you think about the discourse around race right now in general?
Well, that is one of the big issues. That's one of the big problems. I mean, it's hard to talk about race. It's really emotional. It's really, people don't know really how to do it. We've not taught really how to do it. A lot of people have false information about things. But it's a conversation we have to have. And the movies I make really specifically are designed to have those conversations. And the more we talk about it, the better it is.
Is there something that you're able to talk about through movies that is maybe, I don't know, harder to get at in just one-on-one conversations and in day-to-day life?
Well, I think there are a lot of white people that want to have those conversations to black people. And they don't
like
really,
a directional conversation.
Yeah, where they want to ask black people things, there's things that they've seen in the news or things like that, and they feel awkward and they don't know how to say it. They don't know if they're going to be offensive, all of those things. And I grew up in Kansas, and so I had to help white people with those conversations my entire life. I mean, white people would ask me about my hair. They'd ask me about. Things that happened in the news, how I felt about certain public figures, all those kind of things. And so I still get those questions today from reporters. I was speaking to someone about the vest the other day, and he was saying, well, black people commit all the crime. And why is that? And I had to explain. So those kind of awkward kind of conversations where people pick up things from the news and various things and they don't know how to respond to them, that's why those conversations are so important.
Well, Kevin Wilmot, director of Confederate States of America, as well as other movies, and KU professor of film studies, thanks for talking to me today, and good luck in the classroom this year.
Thank you.
That's a wrap for today's Central Standard. You can listen back to anything you've heard today at kcur.org/centralstandard. We keep all our shows archived there, so there's plenty of good listening to check out while you're at it. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, we are wondering if there's a daycare crunch in Kansas City. Is there enough quality daycare to keep up with parent demand? Or are parents having to scramble and make concessions just to keep working their jobs? Call and share your story tomorrow at 10, and stay in touch with us anytime on Twitter. We are at KCUR CST. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Tom Taylor. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next, so don't miss it.